Marxism traditionally has a stand on various issues. A stand on the primacy of class, a stand on the determining nature of the economic base, a stand on ideology, a stand on ideas in general. All ideas are not ideology, but Marxism at least appears to have a theory of all ideas, not just of ideology, of history as a structured thing. Now, there are various ideas that are present in Marxism. None of them is absolutely wrong. The problem is, if I had thought all of them are wrong, it's very easy to dismiss and write whatever. None of them is absolutely wrong, but I think all of them have a partial truth which has been illegitimately extended into a total truth. So what happens is, in different contexts, one will have to discuss different things. When one talks about ideas and ideology, is it the case that every idea can be attributed to some either class interest or class practice? Attributing ideas to class interest is a dogmatic kind of Marxism. But then within the Marxist tradition, there are broader interpretations in which you don't say class interest but class practice. That is, the practice of a certain class gives rise to certain ideas, which may or may not correspond with any predetermined interest of the class, but it is born from the practice of that class. But even in that broad sense, is it the case that every idea can be explained as being derived from a certain class practice? Secondly, what is the structure of ideas? Ideas have a particular content and certain general values in terms of which particular contents are expressed. Now, these general values are always stated universally. Whether they are meant universally or not can be a matter of debate and discussion, but they are always stated universally. And that has the consequence that a particular idea stated in terms of general universal values gets expanded beyond its particular context. Often it even goes to the opposite, like you have rule of law, which we talk about in civil liberties. Even assuming that it came up as a general universal value in terms of which the particular interests of the bourgeoisie were expressed in 17th century, 16th century, later the fact that it is expressed as a universal value has entailed its expansion to a wider framework in which it is not necessarily congruent with capitalist interests, not 100% congruent. So if one, what I'm trying to say is that each of these elements of Marxism gets questioned in a different context. So when one talks about ideology, there are certain contexts in which one has to, ideas and ideology, their class basis, their basis in class interest or class practice. In certain contexts, one will have to bring it up. Similarly, if you are talking about the primacy of class, now in India we see that in terms of actual politics or actual social struggles, class is not really appearing to be primary. Now that can be rationalized in 100 ways. You may say that the stunted nature of capitalist development has resulted in a situation where class formation is not very sharp or strong, and therefore pre-class formations are dominant and so on. That is one explanation. The other explanation could be that class came up as a primary form of social grouping only in European history. It is nowhere else in the world, neither ancient nor medieval nor modern, you find class as the primary unit in actual social and political struggles. So to assume that what happened in European history is the norm and everything else is a deformation which has not happened because of imperialism or something is a peculiar form of logic. That's one kind of logic. You can start with a different logic. If we don't assume that what happened in Europe is the norm, then one may have to conclude that class may not be the primary social unit in terms of public life. After all, the whole discussion from the time of Marx till today about Asian societies has been that because of some reason, some Asiatic mode of production has come up, and because of that, class formation has not been very sharp, and because of that, class struggles have not been very sharp. All this because of implies that what happened in Europe must have happened here. Because it did not happen here, there has to be some reason for it. Why should that kind of an argument be there? So in this context, one has to, and especially when one talks about India in the context of caste as a major phenomenon which has come forward as a focus of mobilization, political mobilization. Then in that context one will have to talk about whether class is the really primary element in society. Similarly, inevitability of socialism and other things. In the whole of the Marxist tradition, the reason why capitalism is always going to be crisis ridden, that I think is a major achievement of Marx, that capitalism will be always crisis ridden, and the particular way in which it will be crisis ridden was very sharply, beautifully predicted by Marx. That is true. But he also believed that within this crisis ridden capitalism, a force will come up which will build socialism. That I think is neither logically nor historically substantiated, that the working class will struggle and build socialism. So the working class will struggle whenever it is oppressed. Every class will struggle where it is oppressed. But the struggling working class, its struggles will either inevitably, in the sense of the natural law, as Plekhanov and Kautsky and others spoke, which was actually not the kind of terminology Marx ever used. But Marx also believed, though he would never have used words like iron law of history, which Plekhanov, Kautsky and even Lenin used. Marx would not have used such expressions. Still, he also believed that in some sense it is inevitable. Not in the sense of the iron law of history, which his subsequent Marxists spoke of. But in some sense, he also believed it is the natural culmination, the normal culmination that one should expect, would expect from the working class struggles is socialism. This, I think, is unsubstantiated in any sense. And here one will have to ask this question, which Marx never asks, why would human beings want socialism? Why would human beings want socialism so strongly that they will resist everything else and build socialism? Human beings, you can discover they want socialism. You also find that they want power. They oppress other people to establish power over them. The same person also wants socialism. So what human beings want is a very complex. Why, under given historical social conditions, human beings will predominantly want socialism, or a predominant class of society will predominantly want socialism and build it, is, I think, a completely unanswered question. And to answer this question, you need a concept of a human being other than a class being. Within the Marxist tradition, there are two kinds of interpretations. One is the so-called materialist interpretation. The other is what's called humanist interpretation. The materialist interpretation, I think, basically can be attributed to Engels, Plekhanov, Kautsky, Lenin. That's a tradition. Althusser tried to give it a very elaborate form. The humanist interpretation also, both of them have roots in Marx. In Marx, you can quote the origin of both. The humanist interpretation was picked up by Gramsci, is a very major humanist interpreter of Marx, and it goes on. Lots of people are there. But even in the humanist, the materialist interpretation says that the economy, production forces and production relations, the basis of, this is the basis of society, and the contradictions within this, that will determine the course of history. The humanist interpretation says human practice. But of human practice, productive practice is the most important factor. That way it gets linked to the materialist interpretation. But human practice is given primacy. But even here, human practice is taken to be class practice. Even in the humanist interpretation, where human being is given a place, human practice, which is supposed to be the fulcrum of history, is defined to be class practice. And human being is defined to be socially a person who produces intelligently, creatively, with a prior picture in mind, not a mechanical producer, but still a producer. An intelligent, creative producer of material life. That is the essence of human, it's not the essence, human essence, that's not what Marx would say. But it is that aspect of man which is central to history, to the historical evolution. Is that sufficient? The moment you start questioning the primacy of class, then where is class? Where does it become primary? It becomes primary within the historical interpretation. Where is the historical interpretation? The materialist interpretation doesn't have any room for a human being except as a product of material force. The humanist interpretation gives human practice the central position, but human practice is class practice, productive practice. Now, is a human being sufficiently defined as a creative, intelligent producer of material goods? That is to say, is the material physical potential of a human being, physical including intellectual, I am including intellectual and physical, not just brute force, physical, intellectual, productivity, potential of human being, is it a sufficient potential to take note of? Because this human being is supposed to want socialism. He is supposed to want a society where justice is there. Justice is not wanted only by the intellect. It's a moral idea. It is linked to the behavioral potential of human beings. Because to want justice, to realize justice, is to behave justly. You have to behave justly. But to assume that human beings will want to consciously behave justly rather than unjustly, predominantly justly, so that a just society becomes possible, raises the question of human behavior. What are the motivating forces? What is the structure of the human character, structure of the human personality? These are very difficult questions which have no place whatsoever even in the humanist interpretation of Marxist theory. So when one comes this way, one has to take the, what I'm trying to say is that if I'm raising different issues in different contexts, each of the gaps in Marxist theory is adequately raised only in different contexts. And only when one raises it in a context, the thing can be made clear. Only when, then one can have a revision of the whole theory. That is why, that is one reason. The other reason, I have no time. If I am put in jail for 6 months, I will write what I want to write, but nobody wants to put me in jail. That is also. I'll take my time and write. I'll definitely write. I have gradually formulated, and I'm also rereading all that I read more than a decade ago. For the last 8 to 9 years, I practically stopped reading, assuming I have understood all the weaknesses of Marxism, understood that it is not a weakness, the answer is everything I know. And now, because to my mind everything is opened, I'm rereading all that I read, and I'm discovering many things which I had thought are not to be discovered 10 years ago. So that discovery is going on. I think I'll write. That is it. A relatively very good understanding of capitalism as a form of society, at least as a form of economy, and certain aspects of capitalist ideology like fetishism and so on. It is good. In general, I see so much which has come from Marxism has become part of common sense today that we don't really realize that it has come from Marxism. But ultimately, I think any theory, its real victory is when it becomes part of common sense, and what cannot become part of common sense gets dropped. Gets discarded. In that sense, today, for instance, whenever we see anything unjust, automatically we see the structural roots of the injustice. This is something we have learned from Marxism. Now it has become part of common sense. Lots of people who don't believe in Marxism also automatically do this when they see, find something unjust. Where is the structure which is giving rise to the injustice? They automatically try to look at it. And then within the structure, they look at those who are benefiting and those who are losing from the structure. Feminists do this, Ambedkarites do this. Modern Ambedkarite interpretation of caste is so different from Ambedkar's interpretation, though they go on quoting Ambedkar, it is strongly influenced by Marx. Marx's way of looking at things, which is not Ambedkar's way of looking at things. That caste is a structure. Who is benefiting? Who is losing? And once you see injustice as rooted in a structure, that some are benefiting, some are losing, then the consequence, the next thing is that those who are losing from the structure should fight against the structure and transform it. Only then injustice will really go. Until then, whatever you do, injustice will not go. These are all ideas which we today take to be part of common sense. In other words, the fight against injustice, many of the ideas required for the fight against injustice, I think have been formulated by Marxism and have become part of our common way of thinking. It is still not fully adequate because I think the when we talk of injustice and fight against injustice, ideology is very important. There, I think Marxist understanding of ideology is very, very inadequate. Much more needs to be done because ideology is what you believe in. You believe in something not because somebody has opened your brain and injected something into your brain. You believe in because that is the way you understand. Now, why is it that oppressed people themselves understand society in such a way that they internalize the ideas of which are convenient for the oppressive system? It's a very difficult question to answer. The only one-line answer which Marx gives in German ideology is that the ruling class controls the instruments of intellectual production as well as material production. It is one very small aspect of it. That is not sufficient. And subsequently, many ideas have been put forward by Althusser, Gramsci and so on. None of them give the complete answer. Because to give a complete answer, the nature of formation of ideas. And ideas are never born in your brain. They are part of your personality. What you believe is part of your personality, not merely your intellect, not merely a function of your intellect. And when what you believe is part of your I am not saying that it's determined by personality, it's part of your ideas are linked to your personality. Then you have to take into consideration the formation of personalities. Erich Fromm was the only Marxist or semi-Marxist person who tried to understand the formation of personality, ideas as a linked thing, ideology as a linked thing, and why. Given his understanding of Freudian theory of formation of personality, oppressive ideologies are there. Erich Fromm went quite far, but I don't think even his ideas are adequate. Because the optimist in him overcomes the scientist in him after a while. But still Erich Fromm has gone far, very far. So what I'm trying to say is that if we say that Marxism is sufficient for fighting injustice but not sufficient for building a just society. That itself is a slight oversimplification, because Marxism gives us a lot of ideas for fighting injustice, but there is one great lacuna, that is in the understanding of ideology. Precisely because Marxism has no notion of human being as a totality. It has a notion of human being only as an intelligent, creative producer. That is not sufficient for understanding the notion of ideology. By merely saying that the ruling classes produce ideas and inject it into our minds, why can't we produce something and inject it into the minds of the ruling class? It doesn't seem to happen. The reverse seems to happen. So some things are there. It's not very easy to... I am able to identify a few things, but I think it requires a very comprehensive understanding. So, with these deficiencies, nevertheless, Marxism is a very useful, and I think the positive ideas which have come from Marxism, as far as the fight against injustice goes, they will stay. They are no part of the political understanding of the human race, which nobody cannot deny. On the other hand, the reconstruction of society on a just basis, there I think Marxism has practically nothing to offer. Because the only thing Marxism has to offer is to locate a class in society which will build a just society. And then Marx consciously says, I won't say anything about how it is going to be. Though he doesn't have a blueprint, but he has many ideas about what kind of society that just society will be. I think the crucial characteristic is where the full development of each will be a precondition for the full development of all. That one sentence contains so many contradictions, so many problems, that the full development of each person will be a precondition for the full development of the whole. Which is very remarkable in the sense that it does not set individual against society, as many Marxists do. Many communists, many Marxists, in the name of Marx, set the individual against society. The society is important, individual must be subordinated. That is rubbish as far as Marx is concerned. For him, any subordination of individual to society was as bad as subordination of society to individual. A fully developed individual is making up a fully developed society. Fully developed in the complete individualistic sense. Each individual fully developed in the complete individualistic sense, which would shock many communists if one says so. But such individuals making up a fully developed society. Fully developed in the sense that society which does not oppress one section for another, which gives the full human civilizational possibilities, potential to everybody. Now, if this is your definition of communism, I believe that is the, among all the various definitions he gave at various times, this is the most useful and as a goal, it is the most useful one. Between this and the idea that there is I will only identify a class in society which in the course of its own struggle without necessarily aiming to liberate everybody in a selfless manner, but in the course of its own struggle will build that society. Between these two there is a huge gap which neither Marx nor any Marxist has filled. So I think as far as the reconstruction of society on a just basis is concerned, there is very little that Marxism can offer us. Though the just society as defined by Marx, I think is a very fine ideal. I think in its absolute form it is a utopia. It will never be achieved. I think there will always remain conflict between full development of individuals and full development of society. But we can bridge it, we can reduce it, we can lessen the contradictions to a large extent. That's a different way. And one has to work for it. Where do you fix your sight? Marx would agree, everybody would agree that change is not only production and change in production relations and productive forces, it is a comprehensive change. But then, of all the change that is required, naturally you fix sights on one change which is fundamental to the total change. Definitely nobody can accuse Marx of saying only that economy should change, nothing else should change. That's definitely not true. But he deduced from history that change in the mode of production will be the fulcrum around which total change will be linked. Now my own point is this. See, human beings are such that, once again I am introducing a concept of a human being which in this sense is absent in Marxism. Human beings are such that you put them in hell, they'll fight for paradise. You put them in paradise, they'll make a hell of it. Which is not meant as a cyclical argument. That they will build paradise, make hell of it, then build paradise, make hell of it. Some things remain. At each phase, something will remain. What remains? Marx recognized one thing which will remain, that is the development in science and technology. That was supposed to be something which accumulates over history. If that alone is seen to accumulate over history, I don't think we will understand how a just society can be built. But in this continuous struggle to build paradise and then this continuous capacity to destroy paradise, what remains are certain values and certain institutional norms of human life, certain institutions themselves which incorporate these norms. At each stage certain things remain. They remain does not mean they automatically remain. They can remain. Sometimes they do remain. And if we consciously ensure that they remain at each stage, at each cycle, that consciously whatever is the values and institutional norms and the institutions built around these norms which have been created, which could facilitate, they may not be ideal right now, they could facilitate the building of a just society. If they are conserved as much as we conserve science and technology when we move from one phase to another. Within Marxism there is a peculiar thing that everything that survives from one phase to another next phase of history is regarded as a leftover, except in technology. Technology is assumed to naturally, correctly, positively accumulate. Everything is not seen as an accumulation, it is a leftover. And then theory, Marxist theory has to wonder why it is leftover. And for instance, why Greek art is still appreciated? Marx himself had some peculiar answers and Lucio Colletti and others have tried to give some other peculiar answers. Peculiar answers have to be given because you feel uncomfortable that anything other than technology can accumulate in history. If it accumulates, it must be a leftover from the past, which is either a completely redundant, useless cancer which is hanging over from the past, or it will somehow seem that it is an old idea which is re-articulated in terms of some new class interests. Because you can't accept that there can be accumulation of certain values and institutional norms, certain, it could be aesthetic norms, aesthetic values, whatever, in whatever form, I'm not totally ruling out reinterpretation. But that they can also accumulate, just as technology can also accumulate, even though the use of technology is often again determined by future social conditions. There we don't feel any discomfort, but here we feel discomfort. And that is because of the peculiar nature of the theory. I think it's a deficiency of the theory. And therefore, we'll have to fix our sights on what values, not mere abstract values, but concrete in terms of social norms and social institutions, which become binding on human beings through cultural. To what extent this can prevent human beings from making hell of paradise? The desire to make paradise of hell is, it's part of human beings because in hell you are deprived. And when human beings are deprived, they fight. They will struggle. There's no doubt about that. But when once they achieve some kind of an ideal or good relation, then the struggle of one against the other to dominate will again start. That can be prevented only by strongly entrenched cultural norms of justice and equality, which again have accumulated from the time of Buddha, they have gone accumulating. And what the disservice that Marxism has done is by delegitimizing all these concepts attributed to some class interest in the past, and they say therefore it is only that class interest and nothing else. If it still survives, it is again useful for Gandhi to again reimpose some bad class interests on society. This delegitimization of positive values that have accumulated from the past is one of the disservices that Marxism has done to history. It has to be converted into positive values. And that accumulation of not merely abstract values, I'm not talking abstract values. Values are always, they always get incorporated in society. Sometimes they're reinterpreted negatively. The value of sacrifice, for instance, is interpreted very negatively for women. One has to be very cautious about that. How positive value can be interpreted, institutionalized very negatively. Women have suffered it continuously. So the positive incorporation of values, only the positive interpretation of values has to be there. It has to be continuously done so that a buffer gets built in social culture and therefore derivatively in human personalities against the tendency to reduce every paradise to hell. That I think is necessary, and that requires a conceptualization of human being. What is human personality? How is it formed? What are the innate tensions within a human being? One can simply divide, one can say there are both evil and good possibilities in human beings, which are permanent, they are universal. You are never going to get perfectly good human beings or perfectly evil human beings. But when I am talking good and evil, I am talking in terms of good is that which subserves unity among human beings. Evil is that which divides human beings. I am talking only in terms of socialism. In that sense, I am talking good and evil. So both good in the sense of that which unites people and evil in the sense of that which divides people, both are potentially possible for human beings. Now, how is this potential worked into a certain personality type or character type in society? This from psychoanalysis alone has taught us. And that's why a lot has to be learned from psychoanalysis. So all these have to be put together to not to generate one more absolute truth, but to give some idea of how we should proceed. That's what.
Just related to this question, who will monitor all this process?
There, I think we cannot specify any class or any caste or any one pre-assigned liberator.
I don't think there is any assigned to themselves this task.
Well, you see, if it could be Communist Party, if it can get over its ideological theoretical drawbacks, it could be some other party. I am not very interested in which party. I am only trying to say that it's a human task which only human beings can do. There cannot be a pre-assignment of this task to any one class or caste or any section in society. So ultimately, which human beings choose to do this is partly a matter of what kind of human beings are formed by social influences, but partly also a matter because human beings have willpower. Partly a matter of how much we are prepared to overcome our limitations and take up this task. As far as that is concerned, there has never been any vulgarity in Marx's own thought. He never said that only those who are born in the working class will do. His point, I think, was that the experience or life conditions of working class will generate the force necessary for that. Many workers will participate in it, others who are not part of the class may also participate in it. But even in that sense, I don't think one can assign this to any class, this role to any class. It's a human task which human beings have to do. Those who live a life of suffering are more likely to be attracted, but the very fact that they are attracted and they fight often means that they move out of the life of suffering, then they will no longer be interested. Somebody else may have to take it. At some point, even if you have a society like the United States where maybe there is nobody who, in terms of physical suffering, needs socialism, a large number of people may believe that in terms of the kind of emotional, cultural and life which is provided by capitalism, it's a disgusting system and we want a better life. And then the choice may not be only from any one class. Maybe the very big millionaires may not want it, but the rest of society may decide that this is a brutalizing way of life, even if I'm getting a lot to eat and a lot of comforts. Option. We have to take the present form. But whatever the argument given, whatever the excuse given, today the situation is that one cannot call it a people's movement, though it is a political movement for the benefit of the poor. There is no denying that. It still works 85-90% for the benefit of the poor, to protect them from arbitrary actions of the government and oppression of the landlords, to give them economic benefits and so on. It's not a self-conscious movement of the poor. It's actually an armed movement which uses a lot of violence for the benefit of the poor. But then once this this movement gets detached from the poor, becomes a movement above them, over them, to protect them, and to use a tremendous amount of violence in order to protect them or to give them some rights or give them some satisfaction and so on, a gap develops between the people and the movement. Movements have become largely unaccountable to the people. They have very little accountability to the people. They, whenever, even if they invite their own sympathizers to discuss with, because the difficulties, various difficulties and problems, they don't have open meetings with the people. So they sit somewhere and call their sympathizers from the village, what are called the militants. The word militant is used differently in Andhra Pradesh than Kashmir and Punjab. Kashmir and Punjab, it is the armed activists who are called militants. In Andhra Pradesh, it is the persons in village who act as a link between the people and this ML parties. They are called militants. They may or may not be armed. Usually they are not armed, or they have some small weapon with them, not nothing beyond it. They live in villages, more or less, semi-legal. So what I am trying to say is that these parties today, given the situation, have very little direct contact with people. They call their these militants, talk to them, take their advice, and generally go and give the directions to these fellows who will go and implement it in the village. Which means that for the people, even to tell them what they feel is very difficult, unless they do it through the militants. And then you have to tell the militants only what the militants like. You can't tell through them that these militants are bad fellows, you repress them. You can't tell them. So complaint and criticism against the party has become very difficult. We know this because when we go to the APCMC, is the only organization which actually knows what is happening at the ground level. You can meet lots of revolutionaries from Andhra Pradesh who will give you what their party tells you. I don't want to say everything is negative. I would still say that on behalf of the poor people in Telangana, these are the only force. There is nobody else. There is no point in denying that. That does not exhaust all the questions one can ask. One can ask a lot of questions afterwards. The first question is, what is the accountability they have towards the poor people? What is the mechanism that poor people have to hold them accountable? There is no mechanism. So when you go to villages, somebody comes and says, sir, I have been threatened by them. They told me I am doing this bad thing. I have not done so. Then we say, why don't you communicate? They say, how do we communicate? I have to communicate through the village militants, who are the fellows who are actually instrumental in giving me a bad name in the first place. How do I communicate through them? So you please tell them. So we say that we don't have direct contact with them. They say, we know you don't have direct contact, but somehow, please send a message. These are requests we get every day when we go to Warangal, Karimnagar, these villages, and we try to send a message one way or the other. Sometimes in extreme situations we give a public statement also, in, as APCLC, that this is being done, it is wrong, please stop doing this. Sometimes, very occasionally we give. The point I'm trying to say is that their answerability, accountability to the people has decreased a lot. Secondly, the problem with using violence as the principal means of serving any class of society, poor or rich or whatever, is that the violence and terror has to be generalized if it's to work. You cannot have a partial terror aimed only at one class of society. That doesn't work, that doesn't serve your purpose. Because if terror used as a weapon for safeguarding or serving the interests of one class, ultimately it turns out that it always injures your own social base much more than it injures the enemy. It's a fact, which I think somebody was speaking of yesterday also, it's a fact that Kashmiri militants have killed many, many more Kashmiri Muslims than Hindus. Khalistanis in Punjab have killed many, many more Sikhs than Hindus. And Naxalites in Andhra Pradesh have killed many more poor people than rich people. That's how terror works. And then it becomes a very uncomfortable. A poor person is an agent of the landlord, agent of the state, police informer, whatever he may not be. Point is that once you use violence and terror as a means of serving the poor or whichever class, it gets generalized and you start using it significantly against your own class. Apart from the general logic of terror as a means, as a political means, there is also the specific intolerance which communist parties have, that they do not tolerate differences within their social base. They will tolerate the enemy much more. Within their social base, they don't tolerate differences. So a rich man who criticizes them, is against them, may not be killed immediately. He is an enemy anyway. One will kill him any day. But a poor fellow who becomes critical has to be killed today, because he is in the social mess. Now, this is a logic which works very much against people. So that today a large number of the particular communities which are the social base of the next, tribals in Telangana, Dalits, those among them who have gone to school, college, got educated or moved up in society, they have a strong feeling. They have today a strong feeling that even though all of them acknowledge that they have benefited a lot from the Naxalites, but we are in a position where we have to accept them as the only leaders. They cannot seek any politics other than their politics. Don't we have this freedom? Ultimately, the freedom of your own social base, freedom from you, not freedom from the state. From the state. You have in fact fought to get them some freedom from the state. You have done so. You have given them a spine to stand up and question. It's very fair. But the spine to stand up and question you, that you have destroyed. So this is a peculiar position. That is one reason why whenever one talks of repression against them, these days I feel that unless one puts the whole picture and talks of repression in this context, it doesn't serve much use. And it becomes a little painful to go on writing these things again and again, so I'm not writing much. That is the